This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael McKean, first became famous for his role as Lenny in the sitcom Laverne and Shirley. When you think of his musical career, you probably think of his hilarious send-ups in the heavy metal mockumentary This is Spinal Tap and the folk revival mockumentary A Mighty Wind. Well, now he's singing on Broadway in a revival of the classic musical comedy The Pajama Game. It also stars Harry Connick Jr. It's been in previews and opens Thursday. Before we meet Michael McKean and talk about his life and career, let's hear him in The Pajama Game. The show is set in 1954 in a pajama factory where the workers are preparing to strike if they don't get a raise. McKean plays Heinz, the factory's efficiency expert.
The alarm clock rings. It's 6 a.m. And then right there in bed I shave. That's what I said. While I am still in bed I shave. And the lather drips and the bed gets wet. And oh, what a lousy shave I get. But think of the time I save.
Think of the time he saves. Tick-tock, tick-tock, time is future. Tick-tock, tick-tock, time goes by.
How I love to sit and watch those seconds multiply at breakfast time. I grab a bowl, and in the bowl I drop an egg. Then add some juice, a poor excuse for what I crave. And then I'll add some oatmeal, too. And it comes out tasting just like glue, but think of the time I save.
Think of the time he saves.
Michael McKean, welcome to Fresh Air. Is this your first time performing in a classic Broadway musical?
Well, there's, I guess you could call Hairspray a future classic. I did Hairspray for 6 months in 2004. And now here I am back again. And this is indeed an American classic. This is a 52-year-old musical. And we do it in period style. Nothing is updated. They're still fighting for the 7.5 cents raise. You probably won't hear much about that in this day and age. But Pajama Game is definitely from the golden age.
It was really fun seeing you sing straight. And what I mean by that is, like, you're not in character as the heavy metal guy in Spinal
right.
Tap or the washed-up folk guy in A Mighty Wind.
Washed up but on the comeback trail. Always.
So what's it like for you to still be singing in character but to be singing straight?
Well, it's kind of what I started out doing when I was a kid. When I would appear in a lot of shows in high school. Our high school drama coach was, you know, one of those busy bees, and he liked to do a lot of shows, and he liked to do musicals, and we got a lot of game kids, and we had a lot of fun, and it's still fun. It's I think your job should be fun, and if they pay you for it, so much the better.
When I saw the show, I realized, gee, I know so many of these songs, and some of them I had completely forgotten even existed, including one of the ones that you sing, which is called I Would Trust Her.
It's called I'll Never Be Jealous Again.
I'll Never Be Jealous Again. Okay.
Yeah.
Would you sing a couple of lines to refresh our listeners' memory?
Well, it's a little hard to do alone because it's Roz Ryan and I do it together, and she sings a line. They picture this. You're sitting and waiting for her to come back from a date. There I am. I'm sitting. So the refrain is, I would trust her. I would trust her. By George, I swear I would trust her. And kind of seen as a microscope specimen, this don't look like much. But that's what I do for a living.
Now, were you ever a showbiz kid? I'm thinking here of like Martin Short. Martin Short always says that when he was young, you know, he dreamed of having his own TV variety show.
Right.
And he had this really like old-fashioned sense of show business where you had to sing and dance and tell jokes and, you know, like tap dance and all this stuff. Did you have that kind of show business idea in mind when you were young?
I don't think I really had that particular thing. Martin Short's imaginary show was so vivid that I think people all over the world felt that it was real. And of course, it had to become real, and hence Jiminy Glick, which is this kind of great dirigible that evolved out of that notion. But no, I thought of myself as a guy who would do a lot of cowboy movies, because that's all I really cared about when I was very little. And then I, you know, as I got older, I thought, well, I'm going to do theater. I'm going to do Glass Menagerie. I'm going to do, you know, great plays and I'm going to direct them and everything. And I, you know, fate took me out to Los Angeles and I worked on the radio and then I started working on TV. So, you know, reality eventually takes over. But no, I never really had that. I had the dream of maybe someday making a living acting, because it looked like a lot of fun, and it is.
So when your ambition was cowboy movies, which character type did you see yourself playing?
Oh, I was going to be the hero. I like this guy, Lash LaRue, because I think I was kind of a junior fetishist. He wore all black, and he had a whip, and he had like this, he had this kind of black lace-up shirt, you know, that had this kind of shoelace kind of thing. But I had a dark shirt, but I didn't have a lace on it, so I took a ballpoint pen, and I would make these X's on my skin to show where the lacing was supposed to be when I was playing Lash LaRue. So I was into the picture that way. I wanted to be a really tough and kind of easy to misunderstand cowpoke.
Wearing a lot of leather.
Yeah. But, you know, later I just thought, well, this is great. The whole gimmick to this job is that you get to be a lot of different people. And, you know, that's what I've kind of tried to do, is not do one job that was too much like the last job I did, because it's just... Well, you know, it's a great license to be able to be a lot of different people, even if, you know, your physicality or your look keeps them all in the same ballpark. That just makes you a recognizable character actor. But that's what's always sounded interesting to me.
Now, I read that your father was a record company executive. What did he do, and did that connect you in any way to show business?
Well, one thing that he did was bring home a lot of free records. So I had a lot of records that other kids didn't have. When he worked at Columbia, for example, he brought home a record called Ears Holloway. I'm leaving off the H's. It's Stanley Holloway, who played Doolittle in My Fair Lady on Broadway and in the film, and was an old music hall performer. And he had an album of music hall songs. And I was about, I guess, 8 or 9. And the songs are very actable. They're all character songs. And I learned them all, and I thought, you know, this is the greatest stuff ever. And my dad took me to see him when he did a one-man show. Stanley Holloway did a one-man show. And that was really the night I decided that this was a very wonderful profession to entertain people and to go there, and everyone in the whole building is looking at you. It's, you know, what could be more fun than that? So I guess some people are terrified by that, but I think it's swell.
So one of your early inspirations was music hall kind of.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think the idea of taking 3 minutes and telling an entire story and wrapping an audience in that kind of, you know, that kind of vein is pretty impressive. It's a pretty amazing thing.
Do you still know those by heart?
Sure. Sure. There's a song that I know. It was one of the first songs I learned from that record, called Sweeney Todd the Barber. And it uses the same source material as the Sondheim musical, which is now in this amazing, brilliant production here in New York. And I'm not affiliated. I can plug them. And it's the same story, but it's the whole story in 3 minutes.
Oh, would you do some
cool.
of it?
Well, I'll give you the intro.
Okay.
In Fleet Street, that's in London town, when King Charlie wore the crown, there lived a man of great renown, 'twas Sweeney Todd the barber. One shave from him and you'd want no more, you'd feel his razor sharp, then tumble wallop through the floor and wake up playing a harp and singing Sweeney Todd the barber. And there you go.
Wow.
It's
pretty
cool.
I didn't even know that existed. That's great.
Yeah. It was written in the 20s. I knew the guy's name, but I don't right now. He also wrote With Her Head Tucked Underneath Her Arm, the great Anne Boleyn's ghost song that Stanley Holloway used to do.
Huh.
You're in my field now. You'll never escape.
Well, getting back to your dad for a second. So what did he do in the record world?
My father was in mostly in editorial. So he wrote bios. He wrote liner notes.
Uh-huh.
He, in fact, used to farm them out to me. If, you know, if there was an act, this was, I guess, he was with Columbia, then he was with Victor, and then he was with Columbia again for quite a while. And a lot of them were special products. A lot of them were reissues on their budget labels, et cetera. And he would farm them out to me, and I would write these liner notes under the name of David Morpheus. And the joke was I could do this in my sleep. Okay, very egotistical for a 19-year-old writer. And, you know, so... Kids, look into your record collections. All you 40, 50-year-old kids, look in your record collections. See if you got any David Morpheus in there.
So what'd you do liners for?
Well, I did one for Marty Robbins, who was this guy who he had a this record El Paso.
Oh yeah,
famous single. And I wrote this. It was like a, you know, kind of a greatest hits album. And I wrote this kind of glowing thing. And I said, well, I'm sure that Marty's going to keep having hit after hit. And then I got this note that he'd been dead for like 5 years. So we had to do a little editing on that. But, yeah, that's pretty amazing. Very pretentious and kind of amusing now.
This sounds like perfect practice for the mockumentary work that you did later, because you were doing like the real
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of the work you do with Chris is people who take themselves very seriously. And that's kind of the central gag of a lot of his films, a lot of his work, is that whether it's this dog show or this, you know, this kind of folk music or the amateur theatrics in Guffman, you know, there is at its heart people – it's a classic farcical situation. Really, I mean, it's something that is treated as direly important, and you know, on the outside, we look at it and see, guys, don't get excited. It's just a dog show, or you know, what have you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael McKean, and he's now one of the stars of a revival of The Pajama Game on Broadway. Now, you got started performing in The Credibility Gap, which was an improv. Or a sketch comedy group, let's
yeah.
say. And that's mm-hmm. where you met Harry Shearer, who was also in it. And I think that's also where you met David Lander, who played...
No, I had known David Lander, who played, also was later to Squiggy my Lenny, to put him in the verb form. We met at college, and he was out in Los Angeles as of 67. And in 1970, he called me and said, we just fired a guy. Would you like to come in and replace him in this group called The Credibility Gap? And we do, you know, funny stuff on the radio and takes on the news, especially. It was really part of the news department of KRLA AM radio. So I was on my way out there anyway. And so I became a member of that company kind of on a, you know, day player basis, and then later permanently. And yes, Harry had been there for a couple of years. Richard Beebe was kind of the news director of the station, and we would make fun of the news. We'd read a straight news story, and then it would segue right into a sketch, you know, where the characters were Nixon and Agnew and Sam Yorty, who was mayor of Los Angeles forever around that period, and Governor Reagan, and you know, people of that nature. And we tried to cover the news in a satirical way, and we kind of later segued onto the stage and had some interesting times opening for rock acts. And then in 75, David and I started working on Laverne and Shirley. Our friend Penny Marshall had, you know, gotten this show and wanted us aboard as writers and also to do these characters. And so we became TV actors and... That's it. That's the middle of the 70s for me. How about you?
Yeah, it was same for me. My life yeah. was exactly like that. All the performing and the TV and yeah.
Such a cliche.
Yeah, I know. So was Laverne and Shirley like your comic sensibility?
Not really, except that those characters were ours. We came with those characters. David and I had been doing them for 10 years at that point.
Well, how did you first develop them?
Well, we both knew these guys. You know, we knew this specimen of you know, guy in high school. David actually went to the high school performing arts, so he was remembering a little further back to junior high. But you know, I went through public high school, and there were these guys who were just sort of like really kind of loud and kind of tough looking, but kind of cowardly as well. So we just kind of had these two very similar specimens, and it just became something that was fun to do. And Penny and her then husband Rob Reiner heard us, you know, do them innumerable times whenever anyone dropped a hat. And so Penny decided, well, these guys would be really funny, you know, kind of neighbors or whatever. So that's what we did. And we did have to, you know, I think initially they were very obscene. When we would do them with The Credibility Gap on stage, we would do, you know, just a little piece of them. And it was improvised, and it was improvised with the audience, and it was basically, you know, trashing the audience. And, you know, it was we couldn't be obscene on, you know, at 8:30 on a Tuesday night. But, you know, we could be at least moronic. And so, you know, it was an adjustment, but at least we made each other laugh, and at least we, you know, we did have a good time doing that show.
My guest is Michael McKeon. He's now co-starring in the Broadway revival of The Pajama Game. It opens Thursday. Here he is in an episode of Laverne and Shirley. McKeon is playing Lenny. David Lander plays Squiggy.
Hey, Laverne and Shirley!
Oh, Lenny, Squiggy, my, what a surprise!
Hi, fellas, we didn't see you.
That's okay.
Well, see you around. Bye.
Hey, listen, if you're not doing anything tomorrow night, we got the truck. The big one.
Yeah. There's a great makeout picture playing at the drive-in. The Robe.
No, thank you. We're going to a formal society dinner.
Oh, pardon me, ladies.
Yeah. I would have worn my tuxedo, but my polo pony ate it.
How did you first get together? I know you had already been friends with Harry Shearer.
Mm-hmm.
I think you already knew Christopher Guest, too. But how did the three of you come up with the idea for Spinal Tap, for a band that would be a satire of heavy metal bands?
Yeah. Well, Rob Reiner had become a big star on All in the Family, had won Emmys, and he was very high profile. He did a pilot for a show. It was a 90-minute special, a one-hour special of a guy sitting there at home switching, you know, the remote, the channels with his remote. And it was basically a day of TV programming, and that was the pilot. It was an idea. You could parody everything on TV. It's something SCTV later kind of, or around the same time, did something similar to that. And one of the things he wanted to do was a parody of Midnight Special, which was the show with Wolfman Jack, where he would present these rock acts and they would come on and they would do a performance and sometimes have, you know, kind of pre-taped proto video junk, you know, covering the drum solos. So, they created the show. I wasn't working on the show at the time, but Rob and Harry Shearer and Christopher Guest were three of the writer-producers and performers on the show. So, they said, well, we wanted to do this band. So they invited me and said, let's create some band. So we did. We said we wanted them to be English because there was this, at the time, it was like there was this band called Slade who seemed to be on TV more than any American-born act. So we wanted to do that kind of thing. And so we created this band. The original lineup was me, Harry Shearer, Christopher Guest, Russ Kunkel, legendary rock drummer, on drums, and Loudon Wainwright III on keyboards. That was the original lineup. All of us in heavy rock disguise. And so it was a sketch on this. And then later when Rob was going to begin his feature directing career, he was looking around for something to do, they thought, well, let's do this documentary-style, you know, film about this band. And kind of that's how it got underway. And the four of us, myself, Christopher, Rob, and Harry, sketched out this tour and, kind of wrote the scenario without the dialogue, because who wants to write that dialogue? It's much more fun to make it up as you go, especially if you're doing a documentary format. So that's how that was done.
Would you talk about creating your character, David St. Hubbins, who's, you know, a singer and guitarist?
Yeah, and full-time dreamer. he's this guy who kind of entered the spiritual side, and there's no shortage of specimens of this guy, of, you know, for a guy who fancies himself the intellectual among a bunch of not very bright people. I think he fills the bill, and he does a lot of kind of half reading, and like he says in the film, he believes pretty much everything he reads. And finds that broadening. I have found, you know, I have met people over the years, and this is not to knock people who have a spiritual side, obviously, but I've noticed that people will incorporate 10 or 12 mystical disciplines in their lives, a lot of which seem to be pulling against each other, and I don't know how they manage it. You know, what I'm saying is a lot of people kind of fall for everything at the same time, and it makes a real loud thud, and they're the only ones who don't hear it. And I think that's what David is. He tries to be spiritual every which way, and that doesn't work.
I want to play one of the songs from Spinal Tap, and I thought we'd hear Big Bottom.
Okay.
Would you talk about...
A medley of our hit, is what you're saying?
would you talk about the process of writing the song?
That particular song?
Yeah, or another, sure. If it's more vivid, yeah.
Well, there's not much more vivid than that. No, it was actually, there was a song by Queen called Fat Bottom Girls, you know, who it is alleged to make the rocking world go round. You know, we kind of wanted to take, you know, do another version of that. So we did. The stuff we threw out, we are sworn to secrecy about that. But we put in the lines that fit and rhymed.
And
that's it.
And your voice on this, what did you try to do to get the right kind of voice?
I was still just trying to establish who David St. Hubbins was vocally. You know, I didn't really have the right pipes. You know, you need that kind of, that upper register, which I didn't really have. I'm more of a Barry than a tenor. So, you know, I was just still trying to find his timber that was believable. I couldn't get way up there like Mr. Daldry. And, you know, I didn't have a really, really great rock and roll voice. So I was pretty much just trying to find him and to let the voice kind of drip with innuendo, which you don't really need when you got lyrics like this. You don't need innuendo.
Okay.
Innuendo's just gravy.
Well, here's Big Bottom performed by Spinal Tap with my guest Michael McKean as the guitarist and singer David St. Hubbins. That was Spinal Tap, and my guest is Michael McKean, who played the part of David St. Hubbins, the guitarist and singer. It must have been so much fun to do this. Whenever I hear the music or see the movie, I just think, God, that's fun.
Yeah.
What was it like performing on stage? Because you actually did concerts as Spinal Tap in addition to doing the mockumentary. So what was the difference between like doing it for the film and like doing it on stage in front of a real audience that came to hear Spinal Tap?
Well, in 1984, when the film came out, the film had been out about 2 months, and we did just a few cities. We played in Boston, where the film was, you know, running, was still running, San Francisco and New York and L.A. And in between, there were cities that didn't really get the film. We played Detroit, for example, and the film kind of limped along for 2 weeks and then disappeared. So people thought we were real, and it was kind of an odd gig. It was just sort of like, you know, it was people just kind of out in the audience saying, now, who the hell are these people again? Where's the real act? But by 91 or 92, rather, when we kind of launched a full-scale tour with a new album and everything, we ran into our meat and potatoes audience, which is, I think the theory goes like this. We pretend to be this rock and roll band, and they pretend to be our fans. So everyone is sort of role-playing, and it's win-win. We really have a great time, and people get the jokes and laugh at the jokes, but they also, you know, it's a pretty tight band. I mean, we were traveling with our original drummer at the time, Rick Parnell, who was an amazing drummer. We toured again in 2001, just again, you know, just a handful of cities, and had an amazing time, just a great time. And you know, it's the joke that that's hopefully more than a joke. I mean, it's really a fun concert. And if we could figure out a way to actually make money doing it, we'd probably do it again.
One of my favorite lines in the movie is when Chris Guest is talking about how a lot of young girls are afraid of the band because we have armadillos in our trousers.
Yes.
You guys must have had such a good time kind of talking about and making fun of the kind of heavy metal band conceit about their sexual prowess and their sexual endowment.
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah, I guess we did. We tried not to think about it too much. But that's obviously, you know, something... It's kind of a 14-year-old boy's ideal of how to be a sexy man.
That's perfect.
That's really what it is. The girls have very little to do with it because, you know, the girls are, you know, with any luck, of age. And but it's really about the fantasy more than anything else. It's like, I, you know, when you're 14, you think, boy, when I'm grown up and I can go to bars and like, you know, be sexy and take, you know, go home with women, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to, you know, wear this spandex and, and, you know, this fur collar and, you know, I'll have eye makeup and long hair, you know. Or now tattoos. So now you really commit when you're, you know, when you're when you're a young man. Now you kind of really commit. You really go ahead and you put the dragon on your forearm.
Have you had any real bands who came of age during the Spinal Tap era for whom Spinal Tap was a genuine inspiration?
Yeah, but most, I think, in the right way. I don't think there's anybody, hopefully there's nobody who said, boy, those guys in Spinal Tap really had a great time of it on that tour. I don't think they said that, but I think we've maybe inspired people to not take themselves so seriously and to remember that it's about amusement and entertainment and that over the top, you know, is something you do for fun. I think if you're going over the top to make people swoon with, you know, with artistic fervor, I think you're barking up the wrong tree. Hopefully they understand this. There have been a lot of bands who've come up to us and say, that's the funniest movie ever made, and we always have that on our bus when we're touring. And you know, so I think people know that it's a satire and know that it's not, you know, that the world of those guys on that 1982 tour, those lives are not to be envied. But, hey, you know, some very successful bands came up to us and said, boy, that's the saddest movie I've ever seen because they remember the days when it was the things didn't look so good. It really is. It's a bleak landscape they're looking at there. They're watching themselves, you know, collapse. They don't know they're going to be big in Japan any minute and, you know, change, save the day.
Well, we were just talking about Spinal Tap. I want to read something from Rolling Stone from May 24th, 1984. And it says, now that This Is Spinal Tap is at least something of a minor hit, Guest, McKean, and Shearer are talking about another film, one that would spoof the attempted comeback of a once popular folk trio. Quote, guys like us in their late 30s who were hot in the early 60s, said McKean, a folk group getting back together again and not having seen each other for 10 or 12 years. And then Christopher Guest says, my favorite idea is shaving our heads to look like Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary, having a mustache and wearing the turtlenecks and a little pot belly. So you had the idea for, you know, a spoof of a folk trio back in 1984?
Yeah, and we kind of tried to hatch it as a TV special at one point. You know, and we kept kind of making those attempts and breaking down stuff and thinking, well, maybe it's a story about this. We do the story about a folk club like Gertie's Folk City here in New York closing, and there's a memorial concert or, you know, some kind of special concert. And, you know, then it kind of lay fallow for a while. And we were doing Spinal Tap stuff. We were, you know, in 2001, we started, you know, playing some gigs and we re-released the film and did a remix on the music, blah, blah, blah. And so we then Christopher and Eugene had done three films at that point. And so this was kind of the new idea, I guess. No, two. I guess just, yeah, Guffman and Best in Show. And so he said, well, let's take this idea and et cetera. And so he and Eugene expanded it into what became The Story of a Mighty Wind with, you know, with the you know, some eventually there was, of course, more than the trio. There was other acts. And so, the film kind of had a long gestation. But in its current form, it was really the brainchild of Christopher and Eugene in 2001.
So what was the process like of writing the songs? You co-wrote a lot of the songs for A Mighty Wind. Did you immerse yourself in New Christie Minstrel Records and, and The Highwaymen and Peter, Paul and Mary?
Well, we actually we knew the examples. So when Chris said, "Well, we need a sea shanty," so C.J. Vanston, who was the musical director on the film, wrote this tune, which was a very kind of jaunty, kind of hornpipey thing. And Annette O'Toole, my wife, and I wrote the lyrics to what became "Fare Away," which was a song that the new Main Street Singers do in the film. And so in that case, it was like the music came first and then the lyrics. Chris and I wrote "Just That Kind of Day." We just knew exactly what kind of song it was supposed to be, and we just kind of sang it. It didn't take very long, to be honest with you. And others, the title song, Eugene came in with the entire lyric and a version of the melody, and we, Christopher and Eugene and I, kind of reworked the melody and kind of added a bridge and a chorus that was largely different, and did things like that. So there's no one process. Annette and I wrote "Kiss at the End of the Rainbow" alone.
What about "Never Did No Wandering"?
"Never Did No Wandering." Okay, Harry and I were just kind of brainstorming some kinds of songs that we didn't have in the movie yet. And we heard this minor keyed kind of wandering type song played by a group, and you're not going to believe this, an actual folk group from the late 50s called the Yachtsmen. Now, what is more folk and ethnic than yachting? So it was on this record called Hootenanny, hosted by that other, real backwoodsy guy, Jack Linkletter. And it was from the TV show, Hootenanny, and the Yachtsmen did this song about wandering. So we said, well, let's write a minor keyed wandering song about a guy who never went anywhere. So Harry and I wrote that one. And the Good Book song, we wrote that the same, we started that the same day, and then it took us a couple days.
Well, I want to play "Never Did No Wandering." It's a song about someone whose father was a railroad man from the west of hell.
That's right. Bad neighborhood boy, that west end of hell.
Okay, well, let's hear it from the soundtrack of A Mighty Wind. This is "Never Did No Wandering," and it's a song that's sung and co-written by my guest, Michael McKean.
My mama was the cold north wind. My daddy was the son of a railroad man from west of hell, where the trains don't even run. Never heard the whistle of a southbound freight or the singing of its driving wheel. No, I never did no wandering. Never did no wandering. Never did no wandering after all. They say the highway's just one big road, and it goes from here to there. And they say you carry a heavy load when you're rolling down the line somewhere. Never seen the dance of the telephone poles as they go whizzing by. No, I never did no wandering. Never did no wandering. Never did no wandering after all.
Never. That's "Never Did No Wandering" from the soundtrack of A Mighty Wind, the mockumentary spoofing folk music. And my guest is Michael McKean, who is in A Mighty Wind and Spinal Tap, Best in Show, and now he's on Broadway in the new revival of The Pajama Game. Now, the band that you were in A Mighty Wind was called The Folksmen. That's the band we just heard. And there was a period when the Folksmen opened for Spinal Tap.
Oh, yeah.
In concerts. Was that before the movie or after?
Boy, I can't remember the first time. The first time we did that, was quite a bit before A Mighty Wind.
So people couldn't have been in on the joke. They didn't know you were doing a band like that.
No, but what we would do is we would say in the advertising or on the poster, we would say special guests, the Folksmen. And we would have a shot of us. And you see these three guys, and you know, I know this guy's bald now and he's got a mustache, but maybe that could be the same Christopher Guest as this guy who's Nigel Tufnell. You know, it was like a little puzzle in the poster. You know, it's not as deep as Dan Brown, for example, but you had to look and find the story within the story. And we forgot to do it once when we played the Beacon Theater here in New York. We forgot to mention the Folksmen. So we came out as our own opening act, as the Folksmen, and the crowd, who were ready to rock, if I may capitalize, they didn't like it. They were, they wanted these old guys off the stage. And so it was kind of, we had the experience of being booed off the stage so that we could return.
That's
as
really
somebody
funny.
Else. Yeah, I think it's maybe unique.
I read that when you were in college, was it, that you had insomnia?
I still have insomnia.
That's what I was wondering. What do you do with it? Yeah. Do you work when you can't sleep? Do you give up, you know, and just like watch
TV? No,
I
wish I could be that guy who got up out of, you know, a toss and a turn and, you know, gone to work and write things or you know, do music. But instead, I just kind of stay awake and horizontal, and it's not very rewarding. I'm better now. One problem with doing a show is that you come home and your buzz won't stop. You know, you're still replaying the show you did. You know, especially if you've done two in a day, you're exhausted physically. But you've done the matinee and then you've done the evening show. And then you're lying there in the dark and you're trying to, was it the afternoon or was it the evening when I did this? Oh, boy, that was the wrong tack I took there. You know, so it's kind of little mini regrets of the day, I think, that keep me up, if anything does. But I also do a little yoga and I get back to sleep pretty much. Sometimes if I'm awake, I turn on the TV and see what people watch at 4 o'clock. Not much. Pretty much what I was watching before. Yeah. I mean, it's mostly those same movies that I don't want to see again.
Michael McKean, thank you so much. It's really been really fun to talk with you. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Michael McKean is co-starring in the new Broadway revival of The Pajama Game. It opens Thursday. It stars Harry Connick Jr. Here's Connick singing a song from the show that became a big hit.